Hello and welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast number 151. My name is Terry Frost, and this time around, Armin from Germany and I are going to take a look at some strong female characters from classic films of the Paleo Cinema era. And I'm going to do my top 10 list of old movies that I've seen for the first time in 2014 and that I liked a lot.
Paleo Cinema Podcast appears every 2 weeks and is a podcast of classic film appreciation. The rules are simple and two in number. Firstly, the movie has to be more than 20 years old, and secondly, I have to like it. Feedback is very important, so you can leave reviews on iTunes. You can email me at cultguru@gmail.com, that's cult with a K. Or you can head over to the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook. You can like the page there and add your 2 cents worth. Now, this podcast contains adult language and concepts, so enjoy it.
So, I hope everybody survived Christmas, Newtonmas, Kwanzaa, Hanukkah, whatever you got. Hope the time was good for you, and if not, there's always next year, I suppose. We did pretty okay. We visited the Outlaws for the 25th of December and had food and all sorts of things like that. We hit the post-Christmas sales a little bit and picked up a few various things, some good movies. I'm being a bit precious at the moment, and if I see a good Australian, particularly science fiction or genre film, I'm inclined to pick it up on DVD or Blu-ray these days because I want to encourage it. I think that Australia is doing some interesting stuff at the moment, and so I picked up both These Final Hours and Predestination, the two movies I spoke about at the last Martian Drive-In podcast. I picked up both of those on Blu-ray after I podcasted about them. They're out on Blu-ray in Australia, not yet in the United States or the or Europe, but I think they're definitely worth having, and I'm kind of glad that I did that. I picked up a whole bunch of other stuff as well, some weird things. Hatari, starring John Wayne, the Howard Hawks film from 1962, picked up that and watched it. I picked up a Cecil B. DeMille biblical epic, and I know it's out of character for me to do that, but Samson and Delilah has always got a soft spot because it was the first one of those films I saw. It was on in the cinema, in fact. They reissued it in the 1960s, and I saw it in the cinema as a kid and kind of liked it, mostly because of the fact that Hedy Lamarr was very, very hot, not to mention the fact that she's one of the women who created the underlying principles to Wi-Fi and a lot of internet stuff these days, as people have discovered recently. And so all credit to Hedy Lamarr, and I thought I'd get it for that reason. Haven't rewatched it. I think it's in Academy ratio rather than widescreen, which is going to be interesting. But I'm going to rewatch it. I'll cringe at all of the godly stuff in it because I always do that when I see biblical epics. Anytime they go crazy pious about God stuff, I just roll my eyes and try to tune it out and maybe look at the set design or what the character actors in the background are doing rather than concentrating on the kind of slightly cloying piety that you get in Cecil B. DeMille's biblical epics. So we've done a bit of that. The weather's warming up nicely, which is great. I always like that. Melbourne, for some reason, the last few years tends to get more summer after the Christmas New Year period than it does before. So we're going to be for 2 months of quite high temperatures, getting up into the low 40s, maybe centigrade. But we'll see how we go. I'll have to just hunker down, drink lots of cool drinks, and watch lots of movies, I suppose. But anyway, I'm going to start with the list of the top 10 older films that I saw for the first time in 2014. As you might know from the previous podcast, I did the lists of more recent things and genre films that I saw. So I've just got a rough list here. I'm going to go through them, and then I'm going to zip pan over to the chat that Armin and I did last night about strong female characters in classic genre, not genre films, but in classic movies. Anyway, the first one I saw for the first time, and it's one of those ones where I should have seen it years ago but didn't, was Night in the City, the Jules Dassin film. from the early 1950s, starring Richard Widmark, Googie Withers, and Gene Tierney.
Now, you know me better than that.
3 days and three nights and not a word for...
Well, I've been very busy.
All I knew, you were lying in the gutter somewhere with a knife in your back.
Just think, Harry, think. We're younger, stronger, healthier than he is. We've got more life in our little fingers than he has in the whole of his body. Oh, Harry, darling, we must have got to get away from him. Please, Harry, please.
Oh, no, you don't. Not again. Every time you talk, you mix me up so I can't think straight for a week. Thanks, Harry.
Anything, anytime.
Set in the London underworld, and really an interesting film. The film noir lighting on it is fantastic. Widmark, every time I see Widmark in a film that I hadn't seen Widmark in before, I have more admiration for his skills as an actor. By the way, he turned 100 just about a week ago. He wasn't here to enjoy it, of course, but it was his 100th birthday about a week ago. And Richard Widmark, an actor I always like. I think he's always been an actor who, even when he's playing a dumb character, has an intelligence to his acting that I really admire, and did a range of roles. He played a little bit on the Tommy Udo criminal kind of thing, but his character in Night in the City was a bit different from that. And I like the fact that the American actors and the English actors are kind of working together and playing off each other a little bit in that kind of post-war London that is kind of groovy. A lot of it was done on location, which always is nice, because it also gives us a snapshot about how places looked at the time. We lose so much to renovation and the constant churning of a city's look and the buildings in a city, that seeing what used to be there is kind of interesting and kind of groovy as well. So that was the first of the films that I saw. The second one was Fernando de Leo's 1972 crazy Italian crime movie, The Italian Connection, also known as La Mala Ordina, starring Henry Silver, Woody Strode, and Mario Adorf.
This man has $6 million worth of heroin. It belongs to the mob, and all it will cost him is his life. The Italian Connection, the story of an international manhunt, with a cast of international stars, Luciano Paluzzi, Cyril Cusack, and Henry Silva and Woody Strode as the hunters.
I want you to kill him in the most brutal way possible, because I want it to be conspicuous, sensational. In other words, make it obvious that the job was commissioned by the New York bosses.
They've come 5,000 miles to stalk their prey. Now, they're moving in for the kill. Godfather signs your death warrant. There's no place in the world you can hide.
Frank, shoot him!
The Italian Connection. Make it, you'll make a fortune. Miss it, you'll get a little round hole right between your eyes.
That one is over the top fucking crazy. In it, Mario Adorf, who's my breakthrough kind of European actor of the year, plays a small-time pimp in Milan who gets framed for a theft of heroin, and two professional hitmen played by Henry Silva and Woody Strode are sent out to kill him, and he goes bug-fuck crazy and just over-the-top total monster on everybody they send after him. And it's just one of those films that it's got to be seen to be believed. It's kind of over-the-top crazy, mad, and really, really entertaining, which is always a nice thing. So La Mala Ordina, also known as The Italian Connection, if you haven't got that or haven't seen that, definitely do so. It is really, really bugfuck. By the way, all these films are films that I haven't mentioned in Paleo Cinema Podcast, I haven't reviewed in Paleo Cinema Podcast, so I'm being careful to kind of weed out the ones that I reviewed so that I'm not repeating myself on this one. But the next one is really interesting. It's a movie that has two names. In the UK, it was called Wonderful Life, and in the US, it was called Swingers Paradise, which gives a totally wrong impression about it. And it's a 1964 Cliff Richard musical, which is really kind of weird, partly set on the Canary Islands, which is a slightly unusual location. But it's got a vitality to it and a lot fun and just kind of over-the-top crazy, and it's very much unlike American musicals.
With a little imagination, you will find the world can be left behind. Life can be delicious with wishes in your mind.
But it just kind of grabbed me for some reason. It was directed by Sidney J. Furie, who a couple of years later directed The Ipcress File, which shows you that the guy's got range. If he can go from a crazy musical to The Ipcress File in 2 years, he's doing okay with that. And it's also got an interesting supporting cast. Walter Slezak's in it. Let's see, Susan Hampshire and Una Stubbs, who, if people are watching Sherlock, the BBC Sherlock Holmes riff with Benedict Cumberbatch in it, Una Stubbs is in it. She plays Mrs. Hudson in Sherlock. And Una Stubbs, in her younger days, was a singer and dancer and an actor and was incredibly hot. And she runs around this movie wearing tight white capri pants. And yum is all I can say. That's one of the big virtues of this film. It really is a lot of fun. It's very much of its time, but I did enjoy it. And I like the fact that it's just that little bit different from the usual kind of American MGM-style musicals that are out there. The next one's also a British film from 1964, very different from Wonderful Life. And it's written by the comedy team of Galton and Simpson that did a lot of comedies at the time. And it's a kind of old-school British comedy, which looks at a lifestyle that no longer exists. And it's called The Bargee, starring Harry H. Corbett, Ronnie Barker, Hugh Griffith, and a bunch of other people.
Fairmile Boat.
Yes.
They got our names on.
Yes. Nice, aren't they?
Yeah. What are they doing here?
They're ours.
Ours?
Ours. Look, they're our new home, Hemel. I couldn't bear you looking unhappy any longer.
You mean you want to go on the canals with me?
Yes.
You want to work the buddy boat with me?
Yes.
After all you said?
Yes.
And it's a story of a couple of guys who run freight barges through the canals in southern England. And, it's kind of a lot of fun. Harry H. Corbett, who people might remember from Steptoe and Son, a few other things, plays a guy called Hemel Pike, who has girlfriends all up and down the canals that he travels carrying freight through the canals, and gets himself into a little bit of trouble. The role's pretty much the way a comedy does, but it's got a couple of nice little turns. It's got an interesting location, some interesting characters, and an interesting lifestyle that it looks at, which is worth checking out. I'm not sure how available it is. It may well be on DVD in the UK, but I kind of like it. I like it because it's not difficult. It's a bit of fun. It shows you kind of early 19th and 20th century technologies being used to achieve something that now is achieved easily with trucks and things. But there was a whole lifestyle and a whole community that went along with that, which is now lost. And that's a little bit sad, but it kind of opened my eyes a little bit and showed me things I hadn't seen before, which is another virtue of some kinds of films, when they show you things you've not seen before and show them in an interesting and entertaining way. So that is, what number am I up to? That's the fourth one of the films. Now, the next one is a non-English language film starring one of the great character actors of all time, and that is Jean Gabin. And that film is called Les Désordres et la Nuit, which means The Disorder and the Night. It's got Jean Gabin in it. He plays a vice inspector in the French police who takes special interest in the plight of drug addicted Lucky, played by Nadja Tilla, whom he considers to be more victim than criminal. Taking it upon himself to wean Lucky away from narcotics, Valois, that's the character played by Gabin, also wins her love and incidentally smashes the dope ring responsible for her addiction. And this one's kind of a look at the demi-monde of Paris in 1958. It's a 1958 movie. It's not a Maigret film, even though Jean Gabin was making all of the Maigret films at that time. But it's a tough little crime drama. Gabin is very good in it. And really, it's kind of interesting because it's a French crime movie from that time. It's tough. It doesn't pull punches. And you can see where things like the Eurocrime movies that came in the 60s and 70s were highly influenced by this kind of film. It really does show you a part of life in Paris at the time that wasn't really covered by the French New Wave. And, I really liked it. It surprised me how good it was and how the characters were all incredibly sharply drawn. And it's a world that you don't really want to enter into in real life because there are some very tough people in it and they are not reluctant to fuck you up if they need to. So I really enjoyed that because it came from a different cultural background than myself. And it's a French crime films from the era are things I'm going to have to dive into more deeply, along with the 27 other things I'm going to dive into more deeply in the realm of cinema, if and when I get the time to do them. But it's definitely on my list. If I find a movie of that type, I'll definitely give it a go because I'm very rarely disappointed. The next one is a Western, and it's a kind of unusual Western in that it's basically an adaptation of a Shakespeare play. It's Jubal from 1956, directed by Delmore Daves, and the cast is kick-ass good. Glenn Ford, Ernest Borgnine, Rod Steiger, Felicia Farr, Noah Beery Jr., Charles Bronson, Jack E. Lamb. Basically, it's an adaptation of Othello, done as a Western.
If you're a cowhand, how come you stink a sheep dip?
I hired out to a sheep ranch because it was the only job I could get.
But most cowhands would die before they heard sheep.
Show me one.
I guess we can at that. What might we call you?
Jubal Troop.
Jubal Troop. I'm Shep Hogan. This here's my spread. And these here are Pinkham. We call him Pinky for short. And Sam, that laughing hyena, is Carson. You ride good?
Yeah, I can stay on most of them.
Well, we got a couple extra bunks here. You want to use one, and in the morning we can see how handy you are with a saddle. Good night.
I'll read you the IMDb on it. A new foreman, played by Glenn Ford, rejects the sexual advances of a frustrated rancher's wife, which leads to conflicts that could get him killed. And that's pretty much it. It's basically Othello done as a small Western. Beautifully vivid colour in it. The acting is great. Rod Steiger as the Iago character, whose name is Pinky Pinkham, which is going to make him angry at the best of times. It really does have the top game, and Borgnine's very good in it, playing a slightly different role from him, playing a leader of men rather than a follower. And Glenn Ford's a good, stolid Glenn Ford kind of role. And I like it a lot. It really does adapt Othello quite well without losing too much. And Delmore Daves, of course, directed a hell of a lot of Westerns. Really fine director, knew how to use locations in the same way that Bud Bedecker did. And it's not particularly a big budget Western. It didn't have any A-list actors in it at the time. But it definitely brought what it needed to the thing. I'm just looking at some of the other things that Delmore Daves directed, which is a hell of a lot. He did 30 movies as a director. Let's have a look here. Dark Passage, he did that one. Broken Arrow, the original, not the the John Woo version. Treasure of the Golden Condor, Kings Go Forth, The Hanging Tree, A Summer Place. He did a whole bunch of pop boilers later on, but did The Last Wagon, Drumbeat, Demetrius and the Gladiators. And not a bad little director. More known for being a screenplay writer. He wrote screenplays for things like An Affair to Remember, which is a little bit unusual. But I really liked it. I heard that there was an adaptation of Othello done as a Western. I tracked it down. And it did not disappoint me at all. Really top stuff, and one of those kind of sleepers that you don't hear about very much, but really is incredibly enjoyable. The next two movies are a bit of a match pair in that they're both film noirs set in the desert. The first one, and I'll go with them in reverse chronological order, is The Trap, starring Richard Widmark again, Lee J. Cobb, Tina Louise.
How are you, Pop?
No complaints. You look well enough.
You too. You haven't changed much. A little grayer, maybe.
Why'd you come back?
Why not? They say home's the place that when you go there, they gotta take you in.
Okay, you're in. How about some food, Linda?
I asked you a question. What are you doing here?
Pop, Ralph's home. You might say that you're happy to see him.
I could stand some breakfast.
I'll give her a hand.
You stay. I'm still waiting for an answer.
Oh, now, come on. Pop, you can't hold a grudge forever. Life's too short.
Long enough to write a letter or a postcard to let somebody know you're dead or alive.
I didn't know somebody cared.
I brought you up to know right from wrong. It's over 10 years and I'm still waiting for some expression of regret.
All right, Pop. I'm sorry.
Is that all you have to say?
Well, what do you want? I said I'm sorry. I'm sorry it happened. I'm sorry I blackened your fair name in this virtuous community. And I'm sorry I put you to the trouble of sending your son to the reformatory for 6 months. I'm sorry.
You were found drunk in a stolen car.
Yeah, I know. It was your duty.
From the day you were old enough to understand, I taught you a man doesn't take what doesn't belong.
That's right, Sheriff. You taught us honesty. You ran it in with a drill. That and nothing else.
I'll read you the IMDb on this because it is good and it's kind of a bit of a forgotten one. Lawyer Ralph Anderson arrives in Tula, an amazingly remote town in the desert, as a reluctant emissary for mob chief Victor Massanetti, played by Leo J. Cobb, who wants the airstrip clear for his unofficial exit from the country. Ralph's arrival has a profound effect on his estranged father, the sheriff, his brother Tip, an alcoholic deputy, played by Earl Holliman, and his ex-sweetheart Linda, now married to Tip. Tensions build as a small army of gangsters take over the town. Then the situation abruptly changes. And this one's really good. A lot of it's set in the desert. It ends with a nice duel between a car and a plane, a small plane, which is filmed pretty well for at the time. Given the limitations they had on technologies, the plane crash is done really well. Lee J. Cobb is incredibly good playing Massanetti, the criminal. And Earl Holliman and Widmark bring their A-games to this one as well. Again, it's not a large-budget movie, and it's shot maybe 80% on location, which is always interesting. And they found some locations that I hadn't seen before and that make the film really evocative and really do show just what you can do on a small budget with a lot of imagination and just the right crew. So that one's really highly recommended. It's not going to blow your socks off in that some ways, but it's a good, honest little desert-bound thriller, film noir kind of thing. And the other one is a 1953 film, originally filmed in 3D, called Inferno, starring Robert Ryan and Rhonda Fleming, directed by Roy Ward Baker, who people know more for doing things in the UK than the US. A spoiled and alcoholic millionaire, again I'm reading this from Wikipedia, played by Robert Ryan, takes a trip to the Mojave Desert. He breaks his leg after falling off his horse and is abandoned and left to die by his wife, played by Rhonda Fleming, his adulterous wife anyway, and his business partner, played by William Lundigan. So basically they leave him off to die.
Oh, we're really safe now.
Oh, they'll still question us, want us to take them back over our route probably. But it doesn't matter. Our tracks are gone.
They'll want you to take them to the Manganese, too.
I'll take them to some, 60 miles from there. It's no good, but there's nothing they can do about it. So I'm a lousy prospector. All we have to do now is sit tight and let nature take its course.
And this is all the story about how he survives and how he gets back at them as well. As I said, it was written by Roy Ward Baker. Cinematography is by Lucien Ballard, and it's really good. A lot of the stuff, there's a bit of a voiceover thing here, in the scenes where Robert Ryan's in the desert and has to survive. He has to kind of find food. He has to find water. He has to also get off the top of a mountain with a broken leg. And Ryan really is great in this film. He just blows you away at the acting, a lot of which he does without anybody else on the screen or anybody else he's talking to. And it's that unusualness about it, that kind of survival story mixed in with the attempted murder and the kind of film noir femme fatale thing. Works really well. It's not a large film. I did see it in old Anaglyph 3D. I saw it, the 2D version. But the colours in the 2D version are very, very good. They've got that kind of saturated Technicolor look about them. But that one's worth checking out too, if you can find it. Really, a lot of these films are being discovered that are being forgotten. Yeah, the big ones, the big Warner Brothers film noirs and all those things that we know about. But now these little kind of interstitial ones that kind of fell between the cracks are starting to appear and starting to be released. And they're really, really worth your time. I love the fact that these things are being discovered and being brought to our attention, because as a film buff, you can get jaded seeing the same thing over and over again. And when something comes up like this, which is a little bit unusual, you embrace it and kind of take it to your heart. The second last movie I'm going to talk about is a movie that slipped off my radar completely. It's Richard Linklater's Dazed and Confused, starring Matthew McConaughey and a large ensemble cast set in a Texas town in the 1970s at the end of a school year. It's got young Ben Affleck and it's got a whole bunch of other people, but nobody had told me about Dazed and Confused until Liz Travascus and I did it on the ABC local radio in Darwin gig.
This country is founded by people who were into aliens, man. George Washington, man, he was in a cult, and the cult was into aliens, man. You didn't know that?
No.
Oh, man, they were way into that type of stuff, man.
And yeah, I really like it. I think that there's no villains, there's no heroes, there's no real plot arc beyond just getting through the summer in a sense. But it did surprise me how much I liked it and how the kind of birth of the McConaughey persona is seen in this movie. It surprised me and delighted me at the same time. And Liz and I found a lot to talk about with this one. I'm not going to talk about it much now. I may well do it in a future podcast. But Dazed and Confused, really, yeah, Linklater. I'm going to have to revisit some more of his stuff after seeing that fairly recently. And all thanks to Liz for pointing me in that direction. It's a movie that is worth checking out if you haven't. And if you haven't seen it for a while, it's worth revisiting. And that's a lovely thing I've got with Liz doing that ABC gig, is that I'll bring things to her she's never heard about. She brings things to me that are outside my comfort zone. And we don't always agree, but we usually have interesting things to say about the stuff that we're doing. And I always find that real fun, and I find that an energizing thing for me as a movie buff, to be taken out of the comfort zone and just have a chat with somebody who doesn't agree with me. Anyway, the very last movie I'm going to do is another French one. I was kind of deciding what the last one was going to be, but I'm going to go with this one, which is The Adventures of Arsène Lupin from 1957. I'll read you the IMDb on it. Arsène Lupin, a multifaceted gentleman thief, steals two masterpieces from the president of the council. Sometime later, posing as Monsieur Gilles, a wine grower who is marrying his only daughter, he asks several jewelers to come to his mansion and robs them of the gemstones. The next victims of André Laroche, which is Lupin's new identity, will be none other than a Maharaja and Kaiser Wilhelm II himself. And this one's beautifully a period piece. I saw it right at the beginning of the year, and the details elude me. It's written by Jacques Becker and stars Robert Lamoureux and Lucille Pulver. And it's got that kind of gentleman thief thing down pat. It really is great. It's a little bit like Franjou Judex. It's got that kind of feel about it. And having a gentleman thief who's smarter than everybody else, a master of disguise and all that kind of thing, is something that always grabs me, and I want to see more of that kind of stuff. I'm going to have to get the Criterion edition of Judex as well. But this one, really a lot of fun, and I always like it when rich people get stolen from. I think it's our duty to do that. But, yeah, that one was a lot of fun, and even with the subtitles, the playfulness of the plot and the way the actors are playing it always comes through nicely. So that's about it. This is a podcast in that peritoneum between Christmas, the balls of Christmas, and the arsehole of New Year. So I'm just going to take a break now. When I get back, our friend Armin from Aachen in Germany is going to be on with us to discuss strong female characters in film. We each picked three of them, and we picked very different ones, and we had a lot of fun having a chat. Have a guest this time around. It's our friend Armin from Germany again. How are you, Armin?
Hi, Terry. I'm fine. I'm really fine and hope you are well too. Thanks.
Yeah, it's a little bit hot here, but we're doing okay.
Not so hot over here, but...
Well, you chose to live in the Northern Hemisphere, mate. Yeah, that's going to do it.
Terrible. I should move to Australia someday.
Hey, well, you'd be more than welcome. As long as you don't come in illegally, in that case, if you do... The government will treat you incredibly badly and be total bastards to you. But
yeah, heard about this. Yeah,
we're doing what we can. Okay, that's all I can say. It's a work in progress, and we're doing what we can about those people. But anyway, yeah. So, did you get anything good for Christmas?
No, because it's a okay. Good question. Because we decided in the family to basically reduce our present output to zero and just get together and have a nice dinner and spend some quality time and not harassing others or ourselves with for weeks driving around and getting Christmas presents. So, it's a nice relaxing time because the years before I noticed that I was really under immense stress of finding something new, unusual, expensive. Yeah. For everybody, and this is for us all much better.
Yeah, I can see that as an option. Though, most of the things I got from Sally and I. I did get another Paleo Cinema T-shirt.
Great.
Because my friend who manages to get someone to print them up for her gave it to me as a Christmas present.
Nice.
So, yep, so I've got a new one of those, which is good because the moths got it, the last one, and had holes in it.
Yeah.
But, and Sal got me a whole bunch of stuff off my Amazon wish list.
Great, yes.
So I've got The Innocents, the Jack Clayton movie, yeah,
mm-hmm.
with Deborah Carr. I got that. I got Planet of the Vampires, the Mario Bava one.
Ah, amazing, yeah. So let's to see this. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and a few other bits and pieces. And, yeah, so basically what I've got pretty much was movies, and I'm not unhappy about that.
Is it on Blu-ray or DVD?
Yeah, they're all on Blu-ray. Yeah, I made sure I got Blu-ray.
Yeah.
And the other thing I got was something I've always wanted, which is a book that gets mentioned in a James Bond novel.
Yeah, okay.
It's The Expert at the Card Table, which is about card manipulation, by S.W. Erdnase, which gets mentioned in Casino Royale.
Cool.
So I've got a new edition of that, so I'm quite happy with that. I'm going to go through it and see if I can play cards and cheat people and do all that kind of thing.
And get rich.
Not at the casino, though, because those bastards will kill you. But
I assume, yeah. Great.
But yeah, just I'm going to see what I can do. Just play around with some cards a bit. I collect playing cards, so I thought I'd learn how to do something with them.
I never could do this, but I was always envious of people being able to do this. But maybe I'll do it at some point.
I mean, I can do a couple of little bits of sleight of hand, but the thing about it is you've got to practice them a lot.
Yes.
I mean, I can do one-handed cuts. I can cut a deck of cards with one hand.
Nice.
But I can only do it with my left hand because I had the book on how to do it held in my right hand when I was learning. So, basically.
Nice.
Yeah, so I can only do it. I can't do it right-handed for shit. But for the left hand, I'm pretty good, yeah. But anyway, we're drifting off the subject a little bit. So we'll probably do now the usual thing, which is what we've been watching.
Yes.
So what have you been watching that's of interest in the cold depths of winter up there?
This list is maybe from the last 1.5 weeks, and it's a bit more than usual due to the free time, but they are not in any particular order. So let's start with something that's still fresh in my mind, which is finally I saw Snowpiercer.
Oh, cool.
I really liked a lot, except for some specific scenes which I found a bit unnecessary, but I think it's a great concept. It's a nice analogy to political problems and specific questions we have nowadays. And also the acting I found was really solid. And course, I'm into Korean or South Korean stuff, so therefore this was an easy choice for me. And I wondered why I didn't see this before. But I had the DVD lying around for a very long time before I finally saw it.
I just got it on Blu-ray at the post-Christmas sales because the day after Christmas they have sales at all the places. So we picked up Snowpiercer on Blu-ray as one of the things we got there. And Predestination I got as well, which is
Spurring
Brothers. Yeah, so we picked up a few other things like that as well. But, good choice. What else have you been watching?
Then a really bad movie, I have to say, but I just watched it together with a friend of mine who really enjoyed it. So I was for this movie, it was more the enjoyment of my friend than my own enjoyment, which made me kind of enjoy the whole procedure, which is Expendables 3, which just came out in Germany. And I have to say, it's for me personally, without having this friend close to me, it's a wet fart of an action movie. So I think it's really becomes now really clear to me. I mean, it was clear from the first Expendables on, but it was a bit more decent in this one. But then that one, that this is a really old guy who really wants to revive the 80s, but on the other hand, wants to make this impossible thing to also include younger audience and have a PG-13. So basically, a bloodless movie where tons of people are killed, and it becomes so blunt and so uninteresting. I mean, the only redeeming factor of this movie is possibly Antonio Banderas, which I really liked in his role. He's really, fully cliched, non-stop talking Spanish guy who's basically the over-the-top comic relief of the movie. But he was really good in his role. I have to say, although, of course, all the real-life stuff aside, but Mel Gibson is still a decent baddie, so he has some charisma and really is. Of course, in this cast, I would say he's the best actor in the cast, I have to say. I mean, also Harrison Ford had some nice lines, but in total, it's too long, it's too uninteresting, it's too non-violent for such a material, and it's like I said, it's like a wet fart. It's like,
okay,
I forgot it already.
Huh? No, yeah, I know what you mean. There's a lot of movies like that around that you think, why did I bother wasting my lifespan with that one?
Yes, basically.
Yep. Anything else good?
Maybe not good.
Or bad.
Yeah.
I'll go
bad. Next one also was written by Stallone is Homefront with Jason Statham, which is
okay.
It's decent. It's nothing special, but I always love Jason Statham. So basically, whatever he's in, and this is also cliched piece of action cinema, but not bad. I mean, way better than Expendables 3, I would say. then I watched. Okay. Meran Tau, which is the second second movie of Gareth Edwards, so with Iko Uwais from The Raid and 1 and 2, and liked it a lot, so incredible action scenes as expected, way slower, of course, than The Raid, not unexpected, okay. But very nice movie, liked it a lot. Then I watched the Fright Night remake with Colin Farrell because I got the Blu-ray for like €4 or something. So I would never have watched it for a full price or like in the cinema. And as expected, it was quite bad. I mean, to be honest, maybe also the first movie has a very special 80s place in my heart. And I really love McDowell and the whole story arc of vampires being real and being hunted by a kid who is basically a monster kid and loves monster movies, and growing up, the whole angle, and this one, basically they managed to make the main character basically a dick. So there is an angle to him, there is some development in his character, but still it's like, it's weird. I can imagine though when you see this one first and you're a kid of the 2000s that you really like it, so I can understand this. But I can't. Then I watched another Pharrell movie, which I liked more, Dead Man Down. Also not super good, but I get more and more to like Colin Farrell, not just as a good-looking, hunky action guy, but also like a decent actor, I would say. Basically,
right.
Since I saw him in Bruges, but now I see more and more other
Bruges things. Is great, yeah.
It's great, yeah. But this one is also, he plays really like a decent a hitman character with an edge to him and really a nice past, and not nice but interesting past and a nice development.
Yep.
Then I saw again action. I saw a lot of action apparently. Falcon Rising, which is more like a direct to DVD Michael J. White's flick. Which is a bit bonkers because he plays an ex special ops or something who is heavily into post-traumatic stress and is drinking a lot and wants to basically die, but then his sister gets nearly killed in the favelas of I think it's Rio, and he has to travel to Brazil and has to fight the Yakuza in Brazil, which is in itself totally bonkers, but it's a very decent action movie. It's a bit slow in the beginning, but when the action hits, it's really a very decent action movie. And Jay White is, I think, one of the not just upcoming, but really nice to look at direct-to-DVD action stars, and of course way more interesting than the older guys that are slowly drawing out, but still making a lot of movies like Seagal and so forth. So it was really entertaining.
Okay, cool.
Then I watched Street Kings finally with Keanu, and really liked it. So really a very nice police drama thriller action movie. And I have to say, Keanu is possibly not the best actor in the world, but he really works in this kind of material and is really decent actor in this one. And of course, the surrounding cast is amazing. You got Dr. House as a Los Angeles police captain. You got a nice team of crooked cops, which are all shady and ugly guys. And the dialogue is really great in this. It's a really highly advised flick.
It looks like a good cast on there. You've got Forest Whitaker, Chris Evans, Hugh Laurie. Yeah.
They all have decent roles, and they all have also decent playing time to really show their talents. And if you didn't see it, I really highly advise it.
Can you pause there for a sec? I just gotta do something. I'm gonna unplug my mic and plug it into a different port. See if I can hear myself. Wait a sec.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay, yeah, just let me wait for the port to come up. Okay, I'll tell you what, I'll call you back in 1 sec, okay?
Sure.
I won't need to call you back because it's all coming through the headphones now.
Okay.
Cool. Please continue. Sorry about that interruption.
No problem. Then I watched something totally different because I also got it on Blue quite cheaply. Is Blazing Saddles by Mel Brooks.
Classic.
Which is a classic, but which I never saw. I think I saw most of his other output, but this one always escaped me, and it's really a mixture of awkward and funny. Well, it's of course really funny, but kind of interesting to see. And I have to say, I never saw much of one of the main guys, Harvey Korman, I guess.
Yeah.
He's, I think, also in some other Mel Brooks movies. And I really love this guy. This Hedley Lamarr guy is really funny as shit. It's really crazy.
Yeah, I think he did a lot of stuff on Carol Burnett's TV show.
Which I never saw, but...
He did comedy chops on that, and he's great. Blazing Saddles is great. And the funny thing about Blazing Saddles is, the more you know about old Westerns, the funnier it is.
Yes. And it's really also nice to see it nowadays in our political correct age, where certain words cannot be uttered anymore.
Well, there is that. But it was written... All that dialogue was written by Richard Pryor.
Really? Great.
Richard Pryor worked on the script with Mel Brooks and some other guy. So they got him in because they wanted to have him do the black guy stuff.
Yeah.
But he wrote all the stuff for everybody else except the black guy.
Well, it's great to have the interaction between Slim Pickens and Corman. It's really silly and in a nice way.
Yeah, but having those actors in there just makes it work. It makes it pop beautifully.
Yes. No, it works really. It's very great. Then I watched Alex Cross, which I also got more or less cheaply, like most of the movies I talked about.
That is so bad, that movie.
It's not good. And to be honest, I read some of the novels from, what's the author's name? I forgot it now, but...
I forget too.
He wrote a lot of, and I think he's one of the most earning thriller authors nowadays, from America at least. And the novels are actually not bad, although the character is for me a bit bland, I have to say, and he's even more bland in this movie. I have to say it's really, it's nothing to talk about, to be honest with me.
Yep, James Patterson's the writer.
Yes, exactly. Mm. Maybe there still has to be a good movie of one of his novels, because what I saw so far is not. I mean, Morgan Freeman was much better, I have to say, but the movies in which he was in were maybe not terribly interesting, but this one was really bland.
Yeah, but getting Tyler Perry to play Alex Cross in that's a bit like getting Pee Wee Herman to play John McClane.
Yes. I mean, he tries his best with sort of shotgun and trench coat and everything, but still it's not the real deal.
Nah. Absolutely not.
Then I watched Kundu, which is a South Korean kind of Robin Hood-like story about a group of bandits rebelling against the authorities. And
It's
really good, really entertaining. Also a good mixture of action and comedy. And it's really melodramatic, like many, many South Korean movies, but really a nice watch, really entertaining.
Oh, cool.
And it's also a big success and one of the most earning Korean movies of the year, I guess. Then I watched The Purge: Anarchy.
Okay.
And I liked it. It's not bad. I mean, it's a bit sledgehammer in your face, but still, I heard it's way better than the first one, which I never saw. But maybe will not after watching this one, because I think the concept is clear, and if you all put it into one location, it's maybe not much better.
Yeah, I'm writing that down because I'll go with your opinion on that one. But the first one didn't look like much, but I'll take a look at the second one.
Yeah, it's, I mean, it moves fast. It has Frank Grillo, which I like a lot. He's also in in the Captain America second movie, and in Warrior and many other smaller parts. And I'm now actively searching for more movies, including him. So then the last thing I saw on YouTube was the Hellraisers documentary about heavily drinking and drug addicted actors from the 50s, 60s up to now. And really liked it, although it was of course very shallow because I think they crammed in too much into just an hour or something. Maybe there are more parts to it, but I just saw this one part and I found they should have focused more on two, three guys instead of including everything.
Was that based on a book? Because there's a book about that called Hellraisers as well.
This might well be. I didn't research it, but I assume there is some connection, just the name. And I mean, there must be either the guy read the book or it was even the author himself. But I was, of course, mostly interested in the parts about Harris and Reed. And what I did the rest of Christmas, basically, was digging out interviews with Ollie Reed, which were a really great watch. And it's interesting to see how he physically and psychologically changes over the decades and in his presentation and how he really plays the media. And the media, of course, expect things from him like being drunk or being embarrassing.
Did you see the one he did with Michael Parkinson?
Yes.
He was totally, that one's the classic one where he's totally off his face.
Yes. I think I saw several sober and totally drunk interviews. I mean, it's interesting. And there's one scene, it's not really an interview, kind of an interview, where he's in a barber store and getting shaved and his hair cut by apparently like a French guy. And this is also really weird because he really, you get the impression he blasts out these anti-French comments and so forth, but also... he get to like the guy more and more over the course of the interview, and also he comes out with this totally interesting and unexpected comments like can you let me look like a some nobleman, some aristocratic guy, and in the end, can you let me look like Brigitte Bardot? No, I can't do this. but don't you have a wig? You know, I mean the guy's really in such an amazing presence, such a fascinating actor. I mean, and it's really hard to separate, especially in the later presentations, how much is acting and how much is just the booze talking. So,
It's always hard to figure that out.
Yes, but I have to see more things with him. So I saw, of course, a bunch of movies, but there's still a lot of stuff out, especially the earlier work, which I never saw. So.
Okay, cool. So that's your lot, is it?
Yes.
Okay, cool. That's quite an eclectic bunch, so you've done well there.
Yeah.
Okay, let me see what I've been watching. I'll start with that. I saw Tusk, the Kevin Smith movie, which I've got one objection to, which is the fact that they do nasty things to a podcaster.
But
basically it's about a madman played by Michael Parks, fantastic actor.
Mm.
Who kidnaps an asshole podcaster, played by Justin Long, and turns him into a human walrus.
I heard they developed the story in his own podcast, right? So
in the Smodcast, they kind of thought it all up, and they turned it into a film, and it's quite good. I mean, there's a bit of body horror to it, and there are bits of it that are very uncomfortable.
Yeah,
but it's a good, honest little cult movie kind of thing. I think it's been dismissed a little lightly. And, and Michael Parks is fantastic in it. Just watching Michael Parks get crazier and crazier is really great.
Yeah, I'm interested to see this. I heard it's a bit maybe unbalanced, and that's also John Depp in it, right, as a Canadian inspector or something.
Oh, yeah, he plays a French-Canadian, and basically totally Inspector Clouseau's the whole thing. But, I mean, this movie's about turning a guy into a walrus. You can't really take it seriously.
No, of course not. Yeah.
It's just not anything that that you can really... say, this should be more serious. No.
It's not a serious horror movie or drama or something.
Let's see. I saw Lucio Fulci's Zombie.
Ah.
for about the second time. On the Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema, they do a Kris Kringle every year.
Mm-hmm.
And that was one of the things I got from Tim Merrill, who's in Korea. Wow. Is a copy of 40 Zombies, so I watched that. And, yeah, for its time, it's a good, solid horror movie.
And lots of eye trauma, right? Or at least one very prominent.
Yeah, lots and lots of eye trauma, yeah. And, yeah, it's worth seeing. It's very raw and rough around the edges. But, yeah, I did enjoy revisiting that and thought, yeah, I can understand its reputation now. Let's see what else I saw. I'm just kind of skipping through a few things. I saw the Coen brothers Inside Llewyn Davis.
Oh, still have to watch this,
yeah. Yeah, which is kind of cool. Not too much plot there. The whole, whatever plot there is, revolves around a missing cat.
Oh.
But it kind of sets up the folk music scene in New York City in about 1960 very, very well.
Yeah, interesting.
It's a movie that kind of keeps you going just based on the characters and the situations. John Goodman's in there playing a heroin-addicted jazz musician who has a couple of nice scenes in there, which is kind of fun. And, I recommend it. It's probably one I'm going to watch again just so I absorb it more fully. But I enjoyed watching that. That was a lot of fun. It had a great period feel about it. And it has the changes in society really nailed down. So things that now are easy were difficult then in certain social circumstances.
Can I ask you something? Do you know if the main actor is Oscar Isaacs, right?
Yeah.
Do you know if he like sings for real, or was it dubbed? Or?
The information I have is that everybody sang for real.
Cool. Nice.
Which is kind of cool.
Yeah.
And, the acting is very good. All across the way, the ensemble's good, and the period feels fine, and the cat's very charismatic. and it kind of works. Let's see, what else have I watched? I'm kind of skipping through things. I saw a New Zealand comedy, which is a kind of mockumentary about vampires called What We Do in the Shadows.
Oh, okay.
Which Jermaine Clement did, one of the guys from Flight of the Conchords.
Mm-hmm.
It's about a shared house of vampires living in Wellington, New Zealand in modern times, just trying to make their way through. And they get into fights with werewolves and all sorts of stuff, and they're all a bit stupid and just don't get the 21st century. And one of them turns a 21st century guy into a vampire. And that's kind of the breakthrough for the other vampires to kind of get involved with the world a little bit more than they did in the past. Sounds so it's a very funny. It's very funny and highly recommended.
I think I saw it. It was part of the Fantasy Film Fest, which tours through Germany once a year. And I think I saw it in the schedule, but I didn't saw the movie. But I wanted to watch it, but didn't make it. But found it quite interesting. Yeah, great.
Yeah, it is quite fun and. It's got that New Zealand thing where the comedy is a little bit gentle,
mm-hmm.
which I kind of liked, even though there are some scenes of ridiculously over-the-top blood. it kind of works really well. And the other thing I watched today, I got a Blu-ray of this today, picked it up for like $10, was the Howard Hawks movie Hatari with John Wayne, Hardy Kruger, Elsa Martinelli, who else is in it? Red Buttons and a few other people, all set in people who trap animals in Africa to bring to zoos. And, it kind of works really well. Written by Lee Brackett. So Lee Brackett, who was known as a science fiction writer and was also a woman, did the screenplay for it. And lots of good action scenes in Africa of these guys basically lassoing wild African live
animals. Sort of the kid the last time, yeah. Nice.
Yeah, and it holds up well. The print I've got's pretty good. The Blu-ray that they put out here in Australia is quite good. And they do get a little bit more acting than usual out of John Wayne, which is nice.
So, yes.
It holds up well. And it's one of those movies that you can watch with a kid as well. There's nothing there that's particularly...
So nobody gets shot or just the animals have to suffer a bit. So.
Well, one guy got gored by a rhinoceros, but there's not much blood to that. So, you know.
No, just...
Yeah, just a little bit, but and I'm about a quarter of the way through watching The Interview, movie with Seth Rogen and James Franco. Because if we don't watch that, the bad guys win.
Now everybody has to watch it to
film. Yeah, you've got to watch it as the civic duties go. Basically, Kim Jong-un, you can suck my dick. You know, that's the reason you see this movie. It's not too bad at the moment. There's little bits like on the talk show that James Franco does, Eminem comes out as gay.
Uh-huh.
And Rob Lowe comes out as wearing a toupee and all sorts of weird and wonderful shit like that. But, you know, it's no more than it should be. It's one of those kind of buddy comedy kind of things.
Yeah.
So far, at least. And, I'm going to finish watching that when we finish recording. So I'm looking forward to that.
Mm-hmm.
So not much else. What have I been? Oh, yeah, I watched Search. Search is a 1971 TV show about a company that has basically 21st century surveillance technology. They've got these little button things that the guys wear either as a tie-pin or a pendant or on a ring, which enable the people back at the base to communicate with them and access computer databases and do all sorts of things. Burtish Meredith plays the guy back at the base, and they've got a rotating main cast of the three protagonists, with Hugh O'Brien, Doug McClure, and Tony Franciosa.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, they rotate through them as different agents of this organization. And it's quite fun. They get some interesting character actors. You get episodes with people like Don Gordon in it and Cameron Mitchell.
Yeah, nice.
And Rhonda Fleming. All sorts of weird and wonderful character actors show up in it. It's very 1970s in the style of clothing, and the set designs are very funky 1970s, and I enjoyed it.
Cool, sounds nice. Oh, I have to say I forgot two things because you didn't mention the TV series I watched or tried to watch. I finally started watching the fifth season of Breaking Bad, which put on hold for a very long time. I don't know why. I watched the first four seasons in very quick succession, but this one, for some reason, I never started, because maybe I wanted to hold off because I know it's ending after that. So I didn't want it to end, but now I'm of course hooked after starting, and it's maybe not my most favorite TV show ever, but it's really very close to the top. It's really the character development and the dialogue and everything is in the depth of relationships is really it's really amazing. And for some reason, everybody in this show is really deep to my and I'm involved with them and really don't want them to die or anything. So it's let's see. But I managed to didn't get spoiled within a year or so. So it was really hard not to get any spoiler information. Then I watched Fargo, this relatively recent show.
I'm hearing good things about that. It was recommended to me also by Kirsten McDermott when I did Martian Drive, and she recommended that one as well.
It's interesting. It's really interesting, and I really like the two main characters, Martin Freeman and Billy Bob Thornton. There's really interesting ambiguities and stuff you can interpret in different ways. There's nice what the fuck moments, and it goes in two directions you would never expect, and there's stuff in it which are really close to the movie which was the main inspiration for it, and there's stuff like Colin Hanks playing a policeman who wants to be a mailman and doesn't like to be a policeman. The stuff I really like, and of course the main bad character. You just don't know, is he just a plain, devious gangster type, or is he something more? Is he like a supernatural being? It's really, they play nicely with different layers of depth, and it's very hard to describe, which makes it already very interesting, and it's a quick watch. It's like, I think, 8 episodes or something, and it's really highly advised also for me, so I would really always give it a go. Then a thing I actually have to say I started but didn't finish yet because it stressed me somehow was I never saw 24. Now I got the whole box set for like €50, and I bought the whole box set, which was kind of unwise, I guess, because I started the first season, and I have to say I'm a bit split on this because I really liked the way it is created, and I like the main idea, I like the actors, but I had a really hard time watching the stuff at least in a bingey way. So I think okay. I stopped and start again and stopped. And now after a couple of days, I have to say, I don't know if I want to start it again, because for some reason, one thing I really hate is, of course, the obvious thing that you have this advertisement break. So it's not really an hour per episode. It's like 40 minutes. So the whole show should not be called 24, but like 16 or something. But okay. That's a minor thing. But I have to say, I don't really know if I'm really on board with Jack Bauer, because he's basically a government-sanctioned sociopath. And the whole family angle, I have to say, it reminds me a lot of Breaking Bad, where family is the most important thing, and you can do whatever you want, and the end justifies the means, so you can become, can kill everybody else just to save your family. So that's really, I don't know if I really want to, I mean, although it's really tense and really interesting and nice characters, nice Betty actors in there, but yeah, I don't know if I find the time to watch it too, so I have to, maybe give it another chance, but there's so much other great stuff around. So if I compare it to Fargo, I would rather watch 10 times Fargo than start again with 24, I think. So it's way more interesting.
No, fair enough, too. I mean, I've never been that impressed with Kiefer Sutherland as an actor.
Mm.
I think his dad's a good actor.
Yes.
But he's been less than impressive in the things I've seen him in. And because of the political underpinnings to 24, I never really got into it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's a kind of political tilt.
Yes.
To that series that I don't particularly want to spend time with, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
But, fair enough, you gave it a go, and that's not a bad thing at all. But, we should get to the core of the episode now, so thank you for all of that. And that is, we'll try to put together some strong female characters in classic films. Now, I've picked two characters and one actor, and you've picked some positive and negative characters. So have you got the 1, 2, and 3 there somewhere?
Let me see.
Just put them in an order. And we'll do your number 3, then we'll do my number 3, and then we'll go number 2, and then we'll go number 1.
Okay, first off, I have to say I delved into many, many movies, but didn't have the time to rewatch them all, although I would have liked to do so. But, maybe let's start with one of the movies and characters, female characters I like most, which is, I think it should still be within your 20-year range, so not older than 20 years, or 20 years at least, which is, I hope it's at least true, which is Out of Africa with Meryl Streep, which is, she plays Tanya Blixen, which is a Danish-born woman who goes to Africa, marries a rich guy, and gets involved with many, many cultural and political problems, and also delves into an affair with Robert Redford, and it's not only a beautiful shot movie by Sidney Pollack, but it's also an interesting character who has a nice development, who is a strong female character in a time where females were mostly submissive and like supporting their husbands. And it's also one not too unimportant aspect of this movie is also the wonderful music, like pieces of Mozart, the clarinet quintet and stuff like this, which beautifully get together with the African landscape and everything. So it's a masterful movie. And of course, Meryl Streep, as such, she's of course one of the still living strong female actors that comes to mind when you make a list of stronger female actors.
Yep, I'm just checking this out for you. 1985, so it's well within the 20-year limit. So.
Right.
And the only thing I remember about Out of Africa, which I really liked, and this is because I'm a sick bastard, is Klaus Maria Brandau, who played her husband.
Yes.
Won an award for giving Meryl Streep VD.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which, yeah, I told you it was because I'm a sick bastard, but no, I really like the fact that...
Yeah, well,
and I like Klaus Maria Brandau as an actor too. I mean, I think the ensemble, that's good. Let's see who else is in there. Michael Goff, Susanna Hamilton, Michael Kitchen. So, yeah, we've got a pretty good cast in there.
Yes.
Shane Rimmer, who did one of the voices on the Thunderbirds, is in there.
Okay.
Yeah, so, yeah.
Brandau is really a great guy. I recently found out there's an audiobook where he reads letters of Mozart to his wife and so forth. And still to find out if those are real legit letters or if they just made something up. But he's also he's just an amazing audio presence also. So it's really of course, no. if you speak German, but it's like...
Yeah. I first saw him really in Mephisto. I mean, Mephisto is fantastic.
Yes, it is.
And then Never Say Never Again, he played
Great
the villain
Betty,
in
yes.
James Bond movie, yeah.
Yeah, Lava, right, yeah.
So, yeah, it's that's a good choice too. One of those kind of strong, not flashy female roles.
And I was not really clear, because I had several Meryl Streep performances on the strong female side, for instance, also Silkwood, but I have to say... I never saw it, so I didn't feel qualified to really talk at least a bit about this. So this was something that came to mind really fast.
Okay, cool. That's a good choice. I'll give you my number three. Rachel Cooper, the character played by Lillian Gish in Night of the Hunter.
She takes
the children in.
Yeah,
there's a couple of reasons. Night of the Hunter, Charles Laughton's one directorial effort. Fantastic movie. There's nothing you can say bad about the film. And, you know, most of the movie you've got Robert Mitchum playing the fake preacher, Harry Powell. You've got Shirley Winters playing his wife. And then you've got the two kids whose acting can be a little bit kind of ropey at times.
Mm-hmm.
And then Lillian Gish takes them in and proves and makes sanctuary for them. And holds off this psychotic bastard by sheer character and sheer effort of will, and by seeing him for what he is and knowing that essentially he's a coward. And I think there's a bit where she shoots him with some shotgun full of salt or something.
Yes, yes. Yeah,
and he runs around and starts yelping and things like that. And this is like toughest old lady in the universe stuff. And I love it. And Lillian Gish, of course, had a silent movie career with her sister. And, in this one she just kind of brings a gravitas to it and a character-based strength, not a physical strength, but a strength based on character that I really liked. And when she's on the screen, she projects that wonderfully, and I think that Laughton brought out the best in her.
And
at that age, women don't get much, even these days, don't get a chance at these kind of quality roles very often. And I really liked that, because she basically cut his balls off and handed them to him.
I have a quick question regarding Night of the Hunter, because I didn't see it for a long time. I think I saw it twice, but even the second time is a long time ago. But I recently heard some other podcaster talking about this, and what they mentioned, that what I also remembered, was that there is some... I think some kind of tonal shift in the second half of the movie, which I cannot really explain, but... that many people claim that they like the first part of the movie way better than the second one. And do you have any comments on this? Or do you feel it the same way? Or?
I think there's a bit of a change, and the change tends to be that you suddenly understand the mythic nature of the whole story.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not a bad thing. I think that that's a useful point at which to pivot the movie. And yeah, I mean, it becomes, I think it's all done from the children's point of view.
Yeah.
And it's a children's nightmare in a sense.
Yeah.
Seeing it from an adult's point of view, and if you stay in the adult headspace, it looks like a tonal shift. But the shift is in the circumstances of the children.
Yeah.
The shift isn't, if looking at it from a viewpoint, kids. Emotions can be, you know, one minute they can be sad, one minute they can be happy, one minute they can feel threatened, one minute they can feel safe.
Okay.
And I think that the shift in the film is consistent with that.
Oh, interesting. Thanks. Yeah.
Interesting. I just realized I've got it on Blu-ray now. I haven't played my Blu-ray of it yet, but I was just going through the Blu-ray shelves while you were talking.
Nice.
And I've definitely got it on Blu-ray. Very happy about that. So that was my number three. So have you got me a number two?
Yeah, actually, I have several candidates for number two. Let me
sure.
see which.
Yeah, put them out.
I would say another strong female candidate, which I would maybe put on number two, would be Susan Sarandon in Dead Man Walking, which I think hopefully also still is in the 20-year.
I will soon find out. Let me touch some keys here.
I think it's maybe end of 80s or beginning of 90s, but I'm not totally sure.
Yeah, let's find out. I'm just waiting for it to come up now.
95.
95, so we're 1 year short, but that's okay. We'll let it pass this time because it's almost 2015, so we're almost there.
Yeah. So, I think what I like about this character is that she is really warm-hearted, but still tough. So it's, I mean, you will find maybe several more recent female characters which are supposedly tough, and there's this, I think, what do they call it, like Trinity phenomenon, where modern Hollywood tries to build up tough female characters, which are still not strong female characters because they just wield a couple of guns and shoot guys, but they're not really tough in the sense of that they have a really strong core and they really overcome objections and have a nice development, a nice character, a nice background. And I think in this movie we have a really tough but also soft female character, which also is constantly clashing with the Sean Penn character, who's of course waiting for his death penalty, and they nicely create the situation where they really, on the one hand, don't want this guy to die, but on the other hand say, okay, really, he did what he did and he's really, really a shitty guy, but do I really want him to die? And she shows this mixture of sensibility and then toughness, which I really liked a lot. So it's really a nice movie also to watch again, and I think she's the core character for me.
Yeah, based on a real person, apparently.
Yeah.
I think, yeah, which is always a hard ask. I mean, the Karen Blixen one was as well.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, I mean, that's a good choice too. And, but strong in different ways.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, cool. Okay, my number two is actually an actor. And it's a person I think got ripped off most by the Oscars, and that's Thelma Ritter.
Yeah,
fantastic actor. Always, she didn't start in movies really until she was in her 40s, and after she raised her kids, her husband was an advertising executive. She'd been in the theater before that. And then she started doing these character roles, and 6 Academy Award nominations for Best Supporting Actress, and didn't get anything for
it. Oh, my God, yeah. It's a pity.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, things like Pick Up on South Street, where she plays Mo, the woman who sells ties and is a police informant. And she's got that great death scene with Richard Kiley and the interaction between her and Richard Widmark in the movie, where they're basically flirting with each other across a generation.
Yeah.
It's a fantastic piece of acting there. And Thelma Ritter puts it across so well. You know, she's playing a tired person whose life's winding down, hasn't got the breaks that she needed, but she's got a toughness about her, which is fantastic. And even when Richard Kiley, playing a kind of psycho communist, threatens to kill her if she doesn't give him the information, and she stands up to him on her own terms and says, you know, you'd be doing me a favor, just do it. And yeah, it's one of the best death scenes in cinema history. And then she does things like she plays Doris Day's maid in Pillow Talk and has some great drunk scenes with Rock Hudson, for instance.
Great.
She was in Rear Window as well, playing the housekeeper to James Stewart.
Yeah, I think I remember. I just watch her IMDb page.
She's just one of those kind of character actors that played, to a certain extent, played similar kinds of roles a fair bit. But she made them individual, even when the script didn't have what she needed to do that. She was in All About Eve playing the maid in that as well.
Great.
And then she did, well, I'm just trying to find that one role where she played someone, Move Over Darling. She played that with Doris Day,
mm-hmm.
where she played Doris Day's character's mother,
mm-hmm.
as a socialite. And she put that across as well. She went totally out of the working class, played a socialite in that and did a great job of it as well. And Move Over, Darling was the first movie I ever saw in a cinema with my mum way back in the early 1960s. And, I just like the fact that she had range. She didn't get the honors she deserved because she really seriously deserved an Oscar somewhere along the state with six nominations there. She was in some of the classic pieces of cinema of all time. She had one of the best death scenes in any piece of cinema as well. And, just basically, she's like Ida Lupino. She's one of those kick-ass 1950s women
yes.
who just didn't get the recognition they deserved when it mattered.
I mean, nowadays she would maybe easily get an Oscar, I guess. And she even played Lancaster's mother in Birdman of Alcatraz.
Birdman of Alcatraz,
Elizabeth Stroud.
It's just one of those things where, she's a tough lady. Really, really tough lady. And when I see a movie now with Thelma Ritter in it, I'm always looking at her to see how she reacts to the main characters.
Mm-hmm.
And she's always there. She's always in character. She's always there. She's always actively listening rather than just waiting for her turn to say something, which is great. And, all credit to her. She's one of the icons, I think, of paleo cinema in a way.
Yeah, I see. Makes sense.
Okay, so who have you got for your number one?
This will be tough now because...
Well, give me a couple. If you got a couple, put them out there.
Yeah, I would say one of the most interesting female character pairs in a relatively recent but still old enough movie would be Thelma and Louise as two female companions, friends, buddies who basically break out of their abusive relationships and do something that usually only male characters do and drive around in their car and tote guns and really try to break out of whatever suppresses them, but also kind of go all the way without spoiling the movie too much in the end.
Yeah, and also fucking Brad Pitt.
Yes, with a big cowboy hat. Yeah, that's really
absolutely.
That was one of his first roles, right?
It was one of his first feature roles. He did some other lesser stuff, but this is the first one that brought him to people's attention.
Exactly. No, that's I still remember, and there's Harvey Keitel also in it. I think so, this I always fondly remember and have to watch again. But I think this is one of the first movies that tried to combine some of the typical road movie and action tropes with like really some sense of female liberation, I would say. I mean, I have to see it again. It was a long time ago, but I think these are two of the more stronger characters of in a kind of female role.
One of the better movies of Ridley Scott. I just saw his Exodus, which was...
I saw it, and did you like it? I guess not.
No. The only thing I got out of it was, as I've mentioned previously, Joel Edgerton channeling Richard Burton and Anthony Quayle and Jack Hawkins. Basically, he's doing the same kind of slightly strained British accent.
Oh, interesting.
That those guys had, and Jack Hawkins was in Land of the Pharaohs and things like that. So I think Joel Edgerton's tongue was in his cheek playing the Pharaoh in that movie.
I have to say, I just watched the trailer and I thought to myself, did Ridley Scott lose his mind, or is it like the big money of the religious groups supporting this, or what on earth do you think? I mean, to be honest, I have to always subtract my inner anti-religion stance, but on the other hand, I think there's nothing whatsoever that could interest me to watch this kind of movie. Not even the best cast in the world or the best effects in the world.
The effects are very good. I mean, I'll give them that. The effects are pretty good. But there's this really dumb conceit as well where God is played by about a 10-year-old English boy.
Hmm. Interesting.
Manifests, right? Not just as a burning bush and as an abstraction. Mm. He manifests as this little kid being mouthing off instructions to Moses and things like that. It's just one of those things where you think, Ridley, you really do need to go back and do something small and smart. It's a bit like that Robin Hood movie he did with Russell Crowe, which was about the start of Robin Hood's career when Russell Crowe was in his 40s.
Yeah, exactly. I still remember this.
With Cate Blanchett as well. But it's just one of those things where Ridley Scott really needs somebody to smack him in the cheek and go, no, put it down. That's not going to work.
Yes. Yeah, I wonder sometimes how these projects come about. And I mean, it's of course a very complicated process regarding the financing and the script and everything. But on the other hand, I think there should be some sanity check in the end where people say, okay,
I was just looking through the again. Getting back to Thelma and Louise, I was just looking at the other cast. Michael Madsen is in it.
Yes, yeah.
And Stephen Tobolowsky.
Yes.
Who does a podcast as well.
Oh, I didn't know this.
Not too bad at all. I remember seeing that in the cinema with a partner I had at the time, who was crying by the end of it.
Really? Okay.
She was very affected by it, and it was really horrible because she was driving home.
Hmm.
Because I didn't drive at that stage, and I thought, shit, don't drive off a cliff. good choice. So I'll give you my number one, and my one's a bit off the wall as well. It's a character called Kelly in The Naked Kiss.
Okay.
Samuel Fuller's movie. Basically, the first time you see her, her boyfriend, her pimp/boyfriend, has shaved her head, and she's beating him with a shoe and taking only the money that she's earned from him.
Oh.
Strong female character says what she does is decides that she doesn't want to be a hooker anymore. Goes to a town where she's been a travelling sales lady for champagne, meets Anthony Isley, who plays the town sheriff or town cop,
mm-hmm.
and becomes a nurse in a hospital for handicapped children.
Wow.
And gets involved with a local male socialite. And things don't go well for a lot of people in the movie, but she stays strong and stays true to herself throughout the film. She decides that she wants to kind of make up for having been a prostitute by being a nurse for children with handicaps,
mm-hmm.
and does a fantastic job. She is a great nurse. She's a great human being. And she breaks all of those 1960s stereotypes of being a prostitute. She's not a hooker with a heart of gold. She's a well-rounded character. Constance Towers plays her wonderfully. And by the end of the movie, she moves on and lives on her own terms all the way through it.
Great.
It's an incredibly strong female role. Samuel Fuller did a marvellous job with this, but it's got that iconic image of her where the wig falls off her head when she's beating up, and it's all done point of view from the pimp's point of view.
Great.
Of her beating him with a shoe. And I'm not going to do a spoiler on the movie. I did a podcast about it way back.
Uh-huh.
But it's just one of those, black and white, not big budget movies that Fuller did at the time. Like Shop Corridor and those kind of things. But it's highly recommended. And her character in it is, a tough woman. It's kind of proto-feminist film in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
And she's just nothing. There are things that happen around and to her and betrayals that occur that in a lot of other films would have crushed the female character. But she doesn't cave in at all. Made on a budget of $200,000, which is nothing. Cinematography by Stanley Cortez, fantastic cinematographer, written and directed, of course, by Samuel Fuller. But her character is one that stays with me because it's a character from a movie made in 1964. That plays extremely well with a 2014/2015 audience.
Yeah.
She's just way ahead of the curve and way ahead of her time. And just one of those great little roles. You should see that movie.
Yes.
Download the torrent.
It's on my list now. Yeah, definitely. I never saw this. Yeah. One of the Fuller movies I never saw.
But let me know what you think when you see it, because just a great, solid role by a fairly minor actor. I mean, Constance Towers, very fine actor, but just didn't get the breaks as a lot of people did. She was in things like The Horse Soldiers in 1959. Just looking through her.
Okay.
She's in Sergeant Rutledge. And other things, let's have a look here. Hey, she was in The Relic too, that movie from 1997, the monster movie. I'm going to have to...
Ah, The Relic, yeah.
Yeah, I like The Relic. I reviewed that for a website back in the day.
The Relic, didn't dislike, but I have to say the book is so much better. Honest, did you ever read the book? of the series of books?
I started reading it. I do have a copy of it. It's one of those ones where I started reading it. It didn't grab me right at the start, so
it's one of the cases where they really managed to take the most interesting character totally out of the movie. So there's a kind of Sherlock Holmes-like character in the series of books with a super interesting but also weird FBI agent, who's super intelligent, super deductive, and really solves the whole crime. And the police guy is basically his Watson, so, to be honest. And in the movie, they managed to take him totally out of the movie and make the police guy the main guy and take the whole interesting aspect completely out of the movie. So that was a bit of a bummer. But on the other hand,
I'll have to dig out the book and give it another go.
Yeah, it's a whole series. It's still running, I think, by Preston and Child. About a dozen books about this character. Yeah.
Oh, nice. But yeah, so that's it. They're my top three. I want to revisit. Have you got more?
I have a couple of maybe honorable mentions, which I couldn't decide upon, who I definitely wanted to mention as strong female characters. There's, of course, the famous The Bride Wore Black by François Truffaut. Yep.
I'm doing that on a future podcast.
Ah, okay, great. Yeah, of course. I had to watch it again, so therefore I didn't want to put it directly in my list, but I just want to mention it because
played by Jean Moreau.
Yes. And there's a German movie by Volker Schlöndorff, which is called The Lost Honor of Katharina Blum, was an interesting movie about the influence of media and especially the yellow press or like the really bad press on the lives of people, especially in this case on the life of an ordinary woman and her response to this and how she deals with it. It's a really interesting movie. I think I watched in school first, but I was really impressed about it. That's definitely something to watch out for. Then there's and here was a bit but undecided if this really is a strong or weak female character, but at least it was a character I was interested in was the prostitute in Leaving Las Vegas, where I thought she has incredibly strong parts, but also was incredibly weak. But then I thought maybe the story is more about telling us that weakness can be also strength in another point of view. But I definitely like this role. Then, of course, there's Ripley of the at least the first two Alien movies is an incredibly strong female character. And I'm always surprised to find out that I think Ridley Scott wanted to first really use a standard male character for her, so which would totally change the movie, I guess. But she's, of course, one of the first one that comes to mind. Then there's Marge Gunderson in Fargo, which I really love. Mm-hmm. Because she's not over the top, but just way more clever than all her surrounding police officers and other guys, and really solves the case and really but still likable and still not a Sherlock Holmes, but still a normal character and highly pregnant in addition. So that's that's really interesting. Then let me see. I think there are a couple of interesting female characters, but they were from movies which are still a bit too new, so therefore I didn't include them. But if I would have to add more, there is definitely characters like I forgot her character name, but Silence of the Lambs.
Clarice Starling.
Clarice Starling, of course. And maybe another Susan Sarandon character in The Client, one of the Grisham movies, which is probably not a great movie, but it's at least a strong female character, I would say. And then there would be, maybe another one that came to mind was a Japanese flick called Lady Snowblood.
Yep.
But
which then brings you into The Bride from
Bill
as well. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So therefore, you have the whole arc of these kind of revenge-driven characters. I think there's a whole history of female revenge characters, which also leads into the Korean output of like Lady Vengeance and so forth. Mm. But these would be a bit of too new because they're post 2000s. Yeah, I think you get really into problems when you apply this Bechdel or Bechdel test to movies, because then you narrow your selection out quite a bit. Because I think if you apply, actually, I found a website where you can apply the test to a couple of movies. So you are asked to, if you think if a movie passes the Bechdel test, and then I made this test with like 10 movies, and I was only correct for 40% of the movies. So it was really surprising.
Yeah, I think we did okay with the movies that we chose for this, because I know that Kelly in The Naked Kiss is not about the guys particularly. And when she talks to other female characters, it's about either Patsy Kelly plays a nurse, so they're talking about the children in the hospital, and about their own lives. They're not talking about them in relation to men. So that one passes.
Yes.
And let's see, Thelma Ritter. Yeah, it was never about guys with Thelma Ritter.
Yes.
So you got that. And, Night of the Hunter, of course. So, yeah, basically, I think between the two of us, we've picked movies that actually passed the Bechdel test.
I hope so, yeah.
Yeah, which is great. And for me, it wasn't a conscious choice. It's just the strong female characters aren't about, you know, can I get a guy and can I keep a guy?
Exactly. Yeah. They don't define themselves like over their relationships. Yeah.
They live life on their own terms, and that's always a confidence is always attractive too. I mean, confident characters always project better than weaker ones in a sense. So I think we've done okay there. I'm going to revisit this at some stage, so I'm going to get you involved. But I'm trying to find a couple of female friends who can kind of bring their game to it, because I do want to get their opinion as well, and we'll compare it to what you and I have done.
Yes, of course, yeah.
And we'll play it like that, because I think it's worth doing, and I think it's worth telling people that there are strong female characters in older films. It's not just a recent phenomenon.
Yes, but I have to say my selection was maybe a bit biased towards the more recent films, but it's nice that you brought the balance.
Whatever works. I mean, yeah, that's the nice thing about having somebody else do this with me, is that I get something that's not my opinion and not my viewpoint. So that's very much appreciated. It's not a negative thing at all, mate. But anyway, I think we'll finish it up there. Anything you want to recommend to people, maybe, that they check out that you haven't already mentioned?
Let me see. I have a long list, but maybe some of them are not worth recommending.
Yeah.
So let me see. I mean, one of the more recent movies with a female character, which is too new for your Paleo Cinema, but which I would advise everybody, is Lola Runs. There is, a couple of sports-related movies. Like A League of Their Own.
Yep.
Then there is, of course, a whole bunch of older movies with really strong female characters, but I'm not sure if they survived the test. But, for instance, Raiders of the Lost Ark has a beautiful female character, African Queen, True Grit, Chinatown.
Yeah.
And there are really a couple of...
Anything that Katharine Hepburn did, basically, is a strong female character.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. She was born for this role, so.
Absolutely.
Then there's also a couple of really bad examples I found, like Lara Croft, Sucker Punch, or the new Hunger Games movies, which I think are really good examples for quote unquote strong female characters, so which are built up as strong, but do still define themselves a bit in their relationship to the male characters and are really still submissive and only apparently strong.
Very much so. I mean, I think television is getting better at the movies at the moment in having strong female characters.
Right?
There's a number of strong female characters in television all across the board. But, I think we've done okay given the fact that we're both guys.
I hope so.
Yeah, so anyway, have a great new year, Armin.
Yeah, thanks, you too. Thanks, Derek. Thanks for
having me. And take care of yourself. And this one should be out tomorrow night, so I'm going to add my little bit at the front where I talk about the 10 older films I saw for the first time this year that I enjoyed. And we'll get you back on at some stage in the future when I find something that suits your talents.
Thanks so much. It would be great. I'm always happy to join. Thanks. Thank you.
I'll let you get on with the rest of your Saturday.
Yeah, thanks. Have a nice day.
Okay, take care, mate. Okay, take care. Bye. Bye.
And once again, it's time to thank all of the Patreon podcast subscribers. And here are the credits in the style of movie credits. I'd like to thank Alyssa, the location scout, Tansy, the Foley artist, Miss Jane, the wardrobe mistress, Christopher, the gaffer, Chris, the camera operator, Julia, the casting director, Jane, the dialect coach, Gary, the prop master, Morris, the musical director, Armin, the key grip, Tom, the focus puller, Sarah, the special effects director, Ian, the caterer, Grant, the technicolor consultant, Matt-O-Matic, the rattlesnake wrangler, and our new one, Elaine, the scientific advisor. And I'd also like to thank Sally. She's the assistant to Mr. Frost. Thanks to all of the subscribers. And the music in the background you're hearing is Claude Debussy playing Gollywog's Cakewalk from a piano roll of his.